Welcome back to another episode. You're listening to Raw Knowledge, Fearless Training Podcast with myself, Alex Connor. And of course, we're back with another guest. And this morning I'm joined by Britt Brobin. Welcome to the podcast, Britt.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. It's a bit of a drizzly morning here in the Gold Coast. We've had a peak of summer and now winter's kind of showed us again, but it is actually warm, it's humid, and but we're here to have a conversation, so it doesn't matter anyway. So I guess, as always, for the people who are listening, some people might be aware, some people might not be, tell us maybe who you are, what you do, and why, but even, I guess, what you used to do versus what you do now, to kind of give context.
Yeah, so my name's Britt Brobin, obviously. I'm now 26 years of age, and 10 years ago, as a 16-year-old, I won an Olympic silver medal in the women's 10-meter platform event. I was the youngest member of the Australian team for all sports at that time. And now I just purchased my first business. So I run a beauty salon in Burleigh Heads.
Quite a different turn,
yeah.
But I guess there's probably correlations as well, because both of them do require courage and discipline to a degree. And I'm sure we'll, and I'd like to dive into that, because there's a lot of people who listen for business as well. You know, it's sort of quite holistic, but I guess the obvious question is to start with the diving. I mean, that's quite an accolade. One, to, you know, to work at and compete at an Olympic level, get a silver medalist, but also, you know, being so young as well. So was there any specific protagonist to you entering into diving? Was it always a passion? Was it something you got pushed into? Maybe give us some context around that.
It actually wasn't. I got put in gymnastics when I was 4 years old, because I was one of those kids where my mum couldn't really handle all the energy at home, so she put me in gymnastics, and my passion was always gymnastics as a young kid. And then when I was about 10 and 11, I actually got injured in gymnastics, and I kind of like lost the passion a bit. And my dad is a professional photographer, and he was taking photos of Chantel Newbury, who won an Olympic gold medal in diving in Athens. And she mentioned that she was starting this talent identification program for young gymnasts, trampolinists, to sort of recruit them into diving. And my dad mentioned that he had a young gymnast sitting on the couch at home, and she's like, oh, bring her along. So I went to the trial, and it started with about 50 kids, and then each sort of month they cut it down to like the elite program. So then it went to like 20 kids, and then it went to 12, and then 8. And I was actually the first sort of kid in the talent identification program to go all the way through to the Olympics. So it was pretty cool. So I basically have my dad to thank for why I started diving. So, but it was never really like a passion. I was just sort of a kid that liked to do flips, I guess.
You were active, and I guess the gymnasts, you know, that really can sort of go many ways, isn't it? With the gymnastics and just moving your body, whether it's artistically in dance or in the water. When do you remember the first time that you did a dive or some sort of diving, and was it a case of, yeah, this is a bit of me, this is really cool, or was it like, this will do for now?
It's actually funny, because it definitely wasn't like, oh, this is really cool, because I actually, the trial for the sort of elite TID program was in Brisbane. So a couple weeks before, I went to Southport Pool to try diving, because I've never tried diving before. And they set up in this little program for me to try diving. And I remember doing a dive off like the 3 meter, and they're like, oh, like if you do it really well, like they say like you can go up to the 5 meter. And I remember being like trying to do it bad, because I was so scared to go up to the 5 meter. And I was like, so I was like probably not as sort of passionate about diving at the beginning, but when I started to develop the talent and it kind of came naturally to me, then I started to fall in love with the sport. And I think it's been the same throughout my whole career. I never had that like passion that a lot of people have for sport. Like my partner plays football and he like lives for football, but I was never like that. I lived for diving because I had the talent for it. So I think there's like, yeah, that's sort of the difference in the, like a lot of different athletes sort of have, I guess.
There's that whole maxim that they say, you know, the sport chooses you.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I'm just thinking of people I've met over the years, one in particular when I was in motor racing, and there was a particular gentleman, and he loved motocross.
Yeah.
And he was older than me at the time, and I always remember saying, oh, you know, like, you're so good. Why you always seem annoyed. And he goes, I just want to ride bikes. And I said, yeah, but this is... He goes, yeah, Alex, it's different. And again, he had more experience, but he had no fear, but he was really good at something. Yeah. And I always find that quite controversial where someone can be so talented, but they hate it. Well, not hate's a strong word, but they dislike it. But it can be so similar. It was just two wheels versus four. Yeah. Or it might have been water versus non-water.
Yeah, no, you know? Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Which is interesting. So how old were you at this point then when, you know, your dad was a photographer and he took you to that first event?
I was a couple months off turning 12. So, yeah, I was about, 11 turning 12. And then I did my first diving competition in 2008. And then I got fast-tracked through that program pretty quickly. So then 4 years later, made my first Olympics.
Right. Yeah. I'd love to know up until that point, you know, once you got accepted into the squad, the academy, whatever you want to call it, what did the training look like? Can you break it down into how many days, times, types of training? I think a lot of people don't realize maybe the time on, I could be wrong, trampolines or in the gymnasium versus the pool, that sort of thing.
So the elite program was actually in Brisbane and my family lived on the Gold Coast. So my family sacrificed a lot for me. So I, my mum would drive me up to Brisbane at 4:30 in the morning. I would train 6 till 8.
Wow.
She'd drive me back to school on the Gold Coast. I'd go to school 9 till 1:30. She'd drive me back up to training and I'd train 2:30 till 6, 6 days a week. So we were in the car probably like 5 hours a day some days, although Saturdays it was only one session. But so a lot of sacrifice. And
there's
my
a lot
dad
of podcast time
well.
In the car. Just saying. But that wasn't a thing back then.
No,
I don't know.
Like, and I used to just sleep all the time.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. So in the mornings, I'd go up and the 2 hours in the morning was like a gym and a trampoline session.
Mm.
And then in the afternoon when I went back up, it was like a 30-minute dry warm up. And then it was 3 hours in the pool. So it was a lot. It was a lot. And thinking back now, being older, I'm like, how did I do all that? Like, it's a lot of, and it's a lot of,
especially at that age,
different sort of strength training. Like, for instance, like, I don't know, like, you probably know, but it's probably called something different in like a pike up where you lay down flat and you touch your toes.
Mm-hmm.
We used to do that with 1 kilo weights on our ankles, 600 every Saturday.
Wow.
We'd do 30 of them and 20 sets. And like, just things like that in diamond that people don't like notice. And I was like that kid that was like, had a bit of talent, so like my coach would sit next to me and count every single one. So it's like, so that sort of strength and training like outside of the pool was really hard. And I grew up with Chinese coaches, so the training was really strict and disciplined. So
it makes me think about the whole stigma behind like Russians and gymnastics. One of my clients, he's Greek, and he trained at the he's competed at the Olympics as well, and like yourself, I've asked him lots of questions. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
And one thing he said was when he sort of took it to that Olympic level, there was these two Russian brothers that came over to Greece and they started running their academies. And I said, oh, well, what, you know, what was the difference? Because it was sort of like, well, I could stay with my coaches, but we weren't really getting that far, or I could go with these, you know, supposedly Russian gold medalists who were brilliant. And anyway, he made that decision. He kind of got disowned by his club because it was like, you know, as it is.
Yeah.
There's a lot of politics. And I asked him, I said, well, what was the main... Because he goes, he said, I just took it, like, I just developed so much. I said, well, what was the difference? He goes, everything. He goes, they said, forget everything you know. And he goes, and they retrained everything.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because you think you arrive at the same destination, i.e. you're doing the same flips and tricks to a degree, but you just do them in such a way that's optimized. And he was telling me even the hand placements, the way they would do flips, and then you start to realize, oh, that knowledge can give you access to perform at a higher level. So I guess with these Chinese coaches, were they there from day one? And, you know, who are the leading people in the diving? I'm actually quite unaware of it, probably a little bit head in the sand with it all.
No, that's okay.
But give us a bit of a, like, perspective to context it.
Yeah. I mean, the top divers in the world are Chinese. So I think that's why Australia has sort of developed that Chinese coaching method, because we're trying to beat the Chinese. So they've brought the Chinese in. Although now it's completely different. So the Chinese sort of system of running Diving Australia has changed now, so they're actually not running Diving Australia anymore. Like I said, sport in itself has probably changed these days, and I was probably in that last generation of really, I would say, discipline, but it was probably like the way of coaching back then probably isn't looked upon as being great these days, sort mm-hmm. of like the whole coaching system has changed. So from my start in diving to the 2012 Olympics, that was all Chinese coaching. From 2012 to 2016, I had a bit of a coach swap, I guess. I did go to Sydney for a bit just because, yeah, the system in diving, I would say back then, was a little bit broken. So mm-hmm. I was growing up, and sometimes it was hard in diving with Chinese coaches when you did grow up and go through puberty and you, like, you're now a woman, not a kid. I think the training kind of had to change, but for them it didn't really change. So then that's when, like, a lot of injuries happened, and a lot of, you know, when you grow up and you are in elite sport, like, your mental health can change, things like that. Whereas, like, that system back then didn't really cater for that. So I was kind of, like, trying to sort of reach out to other sort of opportunities. So I did go to Sydney for a little bit before the 2016 Olympics, mm-hmm. which was a Mexican coach, actually.
And did you find that that was more suited to you? There's a little more empathy.
I'm still, like, quite good friends with him as well. But no, it was good. It was a different sort of environment. But I obviously then, for the 2016 Olympics, dislocated my shoulder and had to pull out 2 days before. So it still wasn't the best outcome. But
that's tough.
That first sort of few years of being in that Chinese system, like, I don't think I would have got to where I did at such a young age without that. But it was also, like, very hard on the body. So I probably wasn't as nurtured through that mm-hmm. as I probably should have been, because then my career could have probably been a little bit longer. But in that 4 years, I was like, yeah.
Is it because they lack empathy and they just completely hammer you?
Yeah, it's not even, like, I was very close to my coach who took me through to London. Like, he really, like, looked at me as, like, a daughter, but mm-hmm. it was hard. Like, it was, and you were, like, I would cry and bawl my eyes out if I was sick and I couldn't go to training and mum wouldn't take me. And I was the fear of not turning up to training, like, the fear of being injured, the fear of that. And not because, like, within yourself, but the fear of having to tell your coach that you're injured, because they were very strict. Like, I remember one day I suffer migraines, and I had a migraine at training, and it was a Saturday strength day where we do really hard strength. And I said to my coach, oh, I have a really bad headache. And he thought I was just trying to get out of training. So I kept going. I ended up, like, vomiting in front of him, like, everywhere. It was bad. And he made me go to the lost and found, get a shirt, clean it up, and keep training. So that's the sort of, like, and I remember getting in the car that day, and mum or dad picked me up, and they're like, how was training? And I was just like, it was great. Like, and they're just like, this things that you go through as, like, a 14-year-old kid that, like, most 14-year-olds, like, weren't going through. But it was that fear of, like, them not believing you when you're sick or when you're injured. Like, I used to get in the pool with, like, ear infections, like, a cold, and, like, have to dive and, like, show them that I actually am sick before, like, you can take a day off, because it's like, you would never just take. I think in my whole sort of career until I was, like, at that Olympic level, I reckon I could count on one hand how many days I had off. And that was when I was, like, very, very sick. So, yeah.
It's interesting, this facet, because obviously to get to an elite level, you have to make a lot of sacrifices. Yeah. And that, you know, you're going to rub shoulders with not just injury, but true overtraining. There's this big focus on recovery at the moment. It seems to be, like, the thing at the minute, and I think it definitely is, and it was underplayed, and same with nutrition. And I'll direct a question your way in a moment about that, but there is, like, working hard is a given. So, you know, you gotta work hard. It's like, yep, that's cool, but, you know, this being on the grind, all of this carrying, it's like, yeah, that's good, but that should be taken, that should be, like, a fixed, like, if you want to work at a level, that should be we don't even need to talk about that. That's a given. But the intelligence behind it, I think that's where you can, and that's not the avoidance of hard work. That's just the strategy.
Yeah.
And I think that was lacked in that era. And it still is a lot. I see it a lot in athletes these days. Yeah. And they think there's some honor in running themselves into the ground. But what they don't realize is that will actually be a detriment to future or even current performance. Mm. And my question for you is, you know, was there a lot of support around recovery in terms of sleep, again, rehabilitation, whether it was massage, you know, all of these other things that we can do. And again, the biggest one is sleep and nutrition. Mm. And was there any support with nutrition?
There definitely was. Like I said, like these days, it's a lot different than what it was. And like, I get jealous these days of like the sort of support and how things have run because I think, gosh, if I was the 17-year-old I was back then now, I probably would have had a longer career. But, you know, as a 15-year-old, and also, like, I had Chinese coaches and I was an Aussie girl. I wasn't, like, you know, the tiny, short platform diver that a lot of the Chinese athletes are. I was always the tallest platform diver. I always had quad muscles. And, like, there was a period of time where, you know, my coach always instilled in me to be the smallest you could possibly be. And when you're a 14, 15-year-old kid, like, I remember I would train in the morning 2 hours and, like, on school holidays I would stay at the pool all day in the diving office so mum didn't have to do the back. And I would run laps of the ring road outside just to do extra training. So I was already doing 5.5 hours of training and I would run laps. And I stopped eating meat. I stopped doing – and just the mentality of, like, being so scared to put on weight as like a kid. And there was like nutrition back then, but when you're a 14, 15-year-old kid and you've got a male nutritionist who's trying to, you just don't sort of click with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I did go through a phase where I didn't even eat meat for 5 years, and me thinking that that was going to like sort of benefit me. So things like that, I think, are also something that I struggle with when I look back on things, because you go through so many different things, which then created an eating disorder for me when I was in my 20s. So it's like little things like that I probably, as well, like you kind of, you live through them on your own. Like not a lot of people will see all the things that go on in your head. And when you're a 15-year-old kid, you just don't go and tell someone about this. You just think it's normal. It's just like, oh, I'm vegetarian now. Like, I don't like meat. But it's like you go through phases in your life where you think that if you do this, then you're going to be smaller or you're going to be this. And it's hard when you grow up in a pair of swimmers in front of the world from the age of 12 until I finished when I was 24, 25. And it's like you can see every part of you, every change that you have throughout the years. And I didn't go through puberty till I was about 17, 18. And then like you develop into a woman and you don't have a kid's body anymore. So I think that was a really hard thing that I probably didn't have as much support around me back then. Mm-hmm. Like, and there was support, but it was also like a wide range of support for everyone. It wasn't just like they were just sort of like prioritizing you in a sense, I guess. Mm. So, yeah.
Makes sense. You make a couple of good key points there. I think first one is you said you think it's normal because you don't have a comparison, and being that age, you don't know. You don't go, oh, well, I've been here before, or there's access to information on this. And like you said, maybe even having a male coach that can be not intimidating, but you're like, well, there's no familiarity there.
Yeah.
Where sometimes coming from a female, even if the knowledge is the same, it can be a little bit more easily digested. There's a little bit of trust. And we see it a lot in young athletes, you know, like there's this acronym called REDS, relative energy deficiency in sports.
Yeah.
And especially for females, you know, with, you know, the menstrual cycle and then obviously, like you said, becoming a woman, there's a lot more complexity and really fueling the female athlete is key. And it is in males as well, but there's a little bit more to lose as a female. And it's a shame because it is coming now to the frontier of, you know, sport athletes. I've spoken to a lot of professional athletes and male and female, and there wasn't support for them. And it is a shame because there's this whole perception that eating less is better, where it's like, well, if you're expending X amount of calories, it's like a car, you need to fuel the car to simplify it. If you're not getting that fuel, you can't perform, and the body's going to grow naturally despite it. But I've heard this even in the Russian sectors. Mm. And again, I think even in Eastern Europe in general, and obviously with the Chinese, where they want to, and I understand why they want to keep you small, but you can't change human physiology.
Yeah.
And the body is going to want to grow. And that really shouldn't, you know, in terms of a performance standpoint, yes, you could argue, you know, biomechanics and physiology would be better to be this and this and this. Mm. But if it's not a factor you can change, then you should work with it, not against it.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's such a shame that that didn't get attention. But again, I think it's more on the forefront. But obviously that philosophy, I think, will be forever with certain coaches and people until maybe it is bred out. I'm not sure if it will, but it's almost like I think of this is an abstract example, but like Ferrari in Italy. Ferrari is a way of life.
Yeah.
And people will never understand unless they're part of what we call the Tifosi or, you know, that family and the drivers talk about it, you know, but there's certain things that are so rigid on and you're like, yeah, but that's not helping you. But it's like, yes, but that's the Ferrari way. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, but that's unintelligent. And it's a shame that maybe that open-mindedness can't be put in a sport, because for athletes like yourself, maybe that experience, I don't know whether, like, maybe you'd still be doing it now. I'm not sure if that's wishful thinking.
Yeah, I think it's hard as well, because there's not very many of my, like, friends in diving or Australian divers that I don't think I could say that have, like, full confidence in their bodies and how they look. Like, I know even one of my closest friends that went through diving, like, we still talk to her. She still struggles with, like, eating and all that and, like, the way, you know, that your body, and it's, yeah, it is really interesting, because there isn't a many divers that I know that finish with the sport and haven't had mental health issues, body issues, male and female.
Yep.
And, yeah, I think that's really, like, that's a, it's a hard thing as well, because the people, like, a lot of people look at you and they're like, oh, you're an athlete, like, I'd love to have your body, but it's like, you don't see it. Like,
no.
You don't. So, yeah, I think these days it's definitely the world is changing, but it kind of, it's hard when you, I think I have a bit of resentment of how things have run now, because I'm like, damn, like, I didn't get the best of it. But I also have an Olympic silver medal, so that kind of makes up for it, I guess. But
well, that's it. And the thing is, you can't change the past, but you can pay it forward.
Yeah.
You know, and that's whether it's sharing your story on podcasts like this, or even, I don't know, whether you do give back to younger athletes, or even try and connect with them. And you could even be a mentor role, an advocate for the sport, because, I mean, you know, if not you, who?
Yeah,
and if not now, when?
Yeah.
You know, like, someone has to step forward and do that.
Yeah.
And they say, you know, comparison is a thief of joy.
Yeah.
And I talk about this all the time to young men and women who want to look a certain way.
Yeah.
And Instagram has not helped social media, because people, you know, they often go, oh, you know, again, I wish I was as strong as you, or I want to look like this. And I'm like, okay, well, there's all of these things. Just consider, we have to draw a bit of a picture. But we're always comparing ourselves within our wheelhouse to the best of the best.
Yeah.
And we don't know what that person is doing, taking, how long they've been doing it, their genetic predispositions.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's such a shame. And like you said before, so this, we've got body dysmorphia, which most people have anyway, and then it's magnified and highlighted in the spotlight in elite sports, or in those, you know, competitive arenas.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned something before as well, which I'm passionate about, especially with females with eating disorders, because like most people in sport or in physique sports competing, they do have a minor eating disorder just there in the background, and people don't realize it. You know, if someone eats some food and they're depressed and then they have this, they don't realize that is the start. That is a pathway that needs to be addressed. And it's not as simple as going, oh, don't worry about it. Like, don't worry about it. Just eat it. You know, people are like, yeah, that's vague, you know, and I'm not saying that there's any magic formulas, but it's a series of meaningful conversations with someone who cares and someone who can open available strategies, create a safe space and actually help someone create, you know, a better thought process and go, okay, well, how can we change this? Like, it's a process, you know, it's like changing and discreating that identity and going, right, how can we actually come out of this at a certain level? And there's a lot to it. And unfortunately, even people listening, there's not a one word answer or cure because everyone's individual. But I don't know if you feel comfortable maybe speaking on your experience with that, or maybe like where you're at now, or and how you've maybe bridged that gap for people listening.
Yeah, I mean, it probably was at the worst for me in 2016. I moved to Sydney 9 months before the 2016 Olympics because the environment in Brisbane, it just wasn't good. It wasn't a healthy environment. A lot of people had left the Brisbane sort of structure up there, because, and like my mental health was probably at its sort of worst then. So I had 9 months to sort of make my second Olympics, and I actually had had shoulder surgery 2 years before this. So I was finally like getting back into it. Anyway, 2016 came around and I actually went through my first breakup with a guy, and I thought that was the worst thing of my life. Anyway, so I lost a lot of weight because I just like didn't eat. I was in that sort of depressive stage. And I lost about 5 or 6 kilos, and I was already quite small, so 5 or 6 kilos. And the worst thing was I was like, I look great now, like I'm 5 kilos. But like, you know, and I have learnt over the years that if you starve yourself for that long, like, you know, 10 days to 2 weeks, and you lose a bunch of weight, as soon as you eat again, it's just going to stick to you. And like, so I went through the losing 5 to 6 kilos. And then when I sort of started to feel better and I started to eat again, I actually put that back on plus more. And I think that was only probably 3 months out from the Olympic trials, and I had gone through shoulder surgery injuries. So like when you put weight on, extra weight on, and you're a 10 meter platform diver, it's not beneficial. So then I started to really kind of get into that eating disorder phase, because I would think about food constantly, and I knew that like I needed to lose weight, but I was thinking about it constantly. So I would go down the path of like probably binge eating, and then sort of trying to like vomit or things so like that.
Restrict, binge,
and like
restrict,
I remember it was really bad. Like I am comfortable to talk about it now, but like there was stages when I was in Sydney and my family was here, and I would binge eat, and then I would go somewhere else to like try and vomit or try and like, and then you would sit there and you'd feel so guilty. And it did get to a stage where I actually told my coach, and I was like, this is what's happening, and I like, I don't want to go down this path, like, but like I don't know what to do, because like my whole demeanor, my whole everything was just focusing on food. And it was really bad. Anyway, so then I went to the 2016 trials, and I was still a little bit heavier than I kind of wanted or should have been. And I ended up, that was the first competition back from my surgery on my shoulder that I was back. I was like ready to go, like everything. Anyway, then I dislocated my shoulder at that competition, like at the Olympic trials. So that was really hard for me. And it was hard because that eating sort of disorder had a massive effect on that, because, you know, you're binge eating, but then you're not, but then you're, it was just really bad. And it all kind of came to a head that day. And, you know, I do a sport that everyone only cares about really once every 4 years. And I had trained that 4 years, and I'd got to that point. And then on that day, 4 years later, I dislocated my shoulder. They still put me on the team because I was in the top two still, like, because I, they take top two, and they're like, oh, we'll just rehab you to, and I only had like 8 weeks, I think, and with a dislocated shoulder, usually you're in a sling for 5 weeks. And it actually cracked a bit of the bone when it went back in. So it dislocated. And then when I swam up, it like cracked a bit of the bone. So it was pretty bad. And I knew it was over. Like I knew there's no chance that I was like 8 weeks, but I was like, yeah, I'll be fine. So then I like was in a sling for 5 days, and then I was back sort of rehabbing. And I got to a couple of days out from the Olympics, and they I was doing a dive off the 10 meter, and I just like, I was in tears. I was so scared of diving. My shoulder, every time I hit the water, I felt like it move. And I hadn't even done a couple of the dives I was supposed to compete at the Olympics, so then had to make the tough decision of pulling out. And I mean, I had the plane ticket, the uniform, everything.
Shit, that's
48 hours beforehand I had to make the decision. So we pulled out, and then I actually went and had a scan on it, and they were like, we have no idea how you were even diving. Like everything was torn in there. Like I ended up having to have 2 different shoulder surgeries at the same time to even fix it. But it was just like a downward spiral, and that eating disorder, I think, really like contributed to that, because I just wasn't looking after my body. Like my main like thought process was like, I don't want to go to the Olympics and look fat on TV. And like, it's crazy. You think back now, like how you go from a 16-year-old kid that like still struggled a bit with body image, but like you didn't care as much. And then you're like now in your 20s and like that's all you care about more than like the actual end goal of why you're there. So I think that's taken me, I still like deal with that sort of side of it. And I still to this day deal with body image and like foods and things like that. Like, you know, I go through when I'm really anxious or I'm really like stressed, I don't get hungry. And then my brain still thinks, oh, that's good, because then I'm not like, you know, I don't need to eat, I'm not hungry. But like over the years, I have like developed what I know is wrong and what I know is right. But it's taken like a long time to sort of get there. Like it's not, you're not doing any benefit to yourself by starving yourself. So yeah, but yeah, it is, it's hard. It was definitely very hard, and it's hard to like remember those times and going through that, because you just think if someone was there to have guided you every step of the way, then like you probably, I would have been better off. Like, yeah. So
yeah, no, I appreciate you sharing that, because it is, it's, and a lot of people probably need to hear, like you said then at the end, you know, if there was a takeaway, it's that that isn't the way, it didn't serve you.
Yeah,
you know, when establishing what is right and what is wrong and
yeah,
how to fuel it. But again, it's, you know, you need that support, you need someone to kind of give that context and nuance and definition and describe it in a way that, you know, you resonate with.
Yeah,
and it's different because the knowledge is there, but
yeah,
it's not, although it might be readily available, it's in the background with everything else, because it seems like, oh, this is the way to do it, this is how we have to do it, it has to be hardcore restrictive, that's the way forward, where really it's not. And obviously you go too far in the other direction, it's the same thing again. Just a quick one, guys, before we carry on with the podcast, for any of you who are interested in taking your health and physique to the next level and you want to remove the guesswork, you're not quite getting the progress that you want, you're not seeing what you want to see in the mirror, and you're not feeling like you're really moving in the right direction, then click the link in the bio below, the apply button, where you can contact me. We can organize a free consultation, no obligation, and discover whether it's a good fit as coach and client. All right, back to it. With your shoulder, I imagine, I mean, part of that was probably just the discipline that you had, that you got through it.
Yeah.
But obviously when you hit the water, was it just, it took the shoulder, dislocated out the shoulder girdle, and it was like all your scapula that...
Yeah, well, been damaged. My original shoulder surgery when I was in 2014, when I was 18, I actually was over in Rome at a training camp before competing at the Worlds in Barcelona, and I hit the water and I tore my tricep and I stretched my shoulder. So I have very like mobile shoulders, which was always good for diving, but in the end was not good for diving. And I stretched the labrum in my shoulder, and... So then they repaired it and they tightened it up. And then when I dislocated my shoulder at the Olympic trials, I actually hit the water fine. Everyone, like, no one actually thought that I did anything.
Mm.
But when I hit the water, I, yeah, pushed my shoulder. I think it went, yeah, it kind of falls out of every direction, unfortunately. Mm. But, yeah, it pushed out, I think, the front. And then when it went back, it, like, cracked a bit of the bone at the back. But it was funny because when I went to like the surgeon after, he was like, oh, your shoulder was falling apart last year. And I was like, what? Like, no one had filled me in that my shoulder, like the week before Olympic trials, I said, my shoulder's feeling a bit funny. Like it, and they're like, it's in your head. Like that sort of phase, like you've had surgery, like it's in, and they pumped cortisone into it. So I couldn't feel it.
Yeah.
So when I was... at Olympic trials and I put my arms up to start my dive, I felt like my shoulder wasn't sitting in the right place. So I already knew.
Hmm.
And I was already petrified of that dive in itself. Like I just always didn't like that dive. And then I dislocated on that dive. So it was a whole like a very big mental like everything. But yeah, so like the year before, my shoulder surgery had started deteriorating, but I wasn't really aware. And then, so I ended up having to have open shoulder surgery to fix the rotator cuff, and they moved a bit of the bone to the front so that it couldn't fall out the front. And then they also did another shoulder reconstruction to tighten it all up.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, look, hindsight's a great thing, and it's hard to know because genetically, you know, it's like hips and knees and powerlifting and weightlifting and shoulders, and some people like sublactate more than others, and they, it's just the way it is. Hypermobility, you can't choose it, but you know, it's like strength training for the win once again, without being biased. It's like, man, you know, maybe with some structure or some more strategy, the fueling of the nutrition with the recovery aspect, and then building lean tissue, but obviously not to the point where you get massive and huge, but like more for actual performance and stability, coordination, flexibility, balance, speed, power, agility, all those things. It's like, wow, like a little bit goes a long way. Maybe it would have had the, you know, but well, we can't, would have, could have, should have.
From 2016 to 2020, like the shoulder rehab and everything, like the weights training we did, like was really good. Because I actually, after 2016 and having to pull out of that Olympics, I actually took a year and a half off because I was like mentally done. Like,
I can imagine.
Completely done. And then I actually decided, like, oh no, like, you know, I actually did triathlon for a bit to just get fit. I loved training. So I was like complete opposite.
Got to do something.
Yeah. And I got really fit and healthy and strong. And, you know, swimming, like, was like really helpful for me. And I went back to the surgeon. I was like, can I dive again? And he was like, you're insane, but sure, like, I can't tell you no. So I my shoulder was actually really strong again after they told me I should never dive again. And then I obviously went back, and I built, and because of the training I did with triathlon, I was actually really fit. So when I went back to diving, it came really naturally to me, and I actually got back to sort of the top level really quickly. And I did my first competition back, and it was like a really good score, and they were putting me on the plane to Canada and America. Anyway, the next day I woke up and I couldn't lift my other shoulder, and I had scans done, and they're like, you have a 3 centimeter tear in your other shoulder. And I was like, so it was just like constantly, oh, like, man. And you're the strongest
you've been. Can't, like, catch a break.
Yeah, so that also led to my other shoulder being dodgy, and then I ended up having like big wrist surgeries, and yeah, it was a lot of
you've been
of
under
injuries.
The knife a few times.
Yeah.
Your surgeon's best friend.
Yeah. On one arm as well. It was all on one arm. Christ. So yeah.
I'd love to know what it's like, or if you can describe what it's like to stand on the platform, first of all.
Yeah.
And then versus to stand on the platform on the Olympic stage. Maybe we can talk about, you know, the zenith of your career, like when you did achieve that silver medal, which is, you know, something that most people can only dream of.
I mean, the 10 meter, it was funny because I was that kid that I just did it. Like, I never walked down the stairs. Even if I was petrified, I'd still hurl myself off the 10 meter because I didn't want to like look like I was scared or anything like that.
Time feeds fear, so you just like, nah, just do it.
And it's funny because like every time you did a new dive and you accomplished a new dive, you just, it was like this like overwhelming feeling of like something that you can't really describe. Like, it was just such a achievement every time, because like you think,
so was it like a little euphoric in terms of like when you work out, you did a good workout, you had this like dopamine response,
like, and especially on some dives when I was like petrified of them, and I would get through a week of training and I did them, I was like oh my god, like you just feel like it's so hard. You sit in school as like a 15-year-old and you're like thinking about doing this like back 3.5 somersault tonight at training, and you're like scared out of your brain, and you're like, well, these kids just like going home to like do homework or something. Like, it was always like when I accomplished like a good training session, it was like a really like overwhelming feeling. Like, but then like you get to the Olympics and I'm doing a handstand in front of 13,500 people, and it's a different experience. Like, it's funny because the Olympics is probably my most consistent competition I had done. Like, it's over 3 rounds, and all 3 rounds I went from 4th to 3rd to 2nd in all 3 rounds. So like, I had one more round, I could have been an Olympic champ if there was one more round.
Wow.
But no, the girl that won, she had won the previous Olympics as well. But
was she Chinese or?
She was Chinese. Okay. The Olympics was just, it's just a whole, I don't think when you're like, I was a kid, I don't think you really understand. Like, I think now being 26 and I'm like, there's no way in hell that I could get up there and do what I did back then. But when you're a kid, you just don't even like
You don't have a perception. No. Like you said, there's no life experience yet. No. You don't have the fear.
No.
Yeah, you're like, oh, just crack on. That's what we do. Yeah. Whereas you get older, I think there's more to lose, you know, when you have more experiences.
Well, that's funny because, like, when I was going into the Olympic final, I was obviously really, like, nervous, like, just those nerves. And I went up to my coach to get this really, like, profound, like, pep talk. I was like, oh, what's he gonna say? Like, he's about to, like, hype me up. Like, let's go. Like, we're going to the Olympic final. And he's Chinese, and he just said to me, like, how are you feeling? And I was like, yeah, good. And he's like, don't worry. What did he say? He's like, don't worry. If you mess up, it's okay. You're young. They'll forgive you. And I was like, and that's all he said. That was his big pep talk. Like, don't worry. Like, you're at the Olympics. You're here now. Like, if you mess up, you're still young. Like, they'll forgive you. Like, and I was like, I remember going into the bathroom, looking at myself in the mirror, being like, shit, oh my God, like, we're at the Olympics. So it's like, it's funny, like, just like little things like that you remember. And like, when you are a kid, like, you're 16, and I had the ability to win and I had the ability to be last. Like, it was really like, when you're that young, and the year before that, I actually beat that Olympic champion in like the best competition I'd ever done. So I had the ability to win.
Yeah.
Wow. But I also had the ability to do what I did at a couple of competitions and come like last. So it was really like fair game, I guess. So
yeah.
Especially with diving, because you go slightly off and it's...
So, I guess before we kind of transition into present day stuff, what are the judges looking for? What makes a great diver? Because I imagine there's a lot of time on the trampoline as well. Because like you said, you see them start with handstands now, and you're like,
yeah.
You know, how do you sort of, all these little questions of like, how do you know where you are in space and time? Like hitting the water, like doing triple backflips. Like maybe give us a little bit of insight towards that.
I think you're naturally born with aerial awareness, or you're not. Mm. And I think I had, as much as I had a fear of some dives, because there was a dive there that I was good at, but I had no idea where I was in the air. It was just a feeling. Like, I couldn't tell you how many somersaults I was at, but then you just know when to come out. Like, it's a weird, it's just that aerial awareness. And I stuffed it up a lot of times. And like, when you stuff it up off a 10 meter, obviously it's like,
hurts.
Not good. But it is a lot of aerial awareness training, like a lot of training. Whenever I went forwards, I didn't know where I was, but when I went backwards, I knew exactly where I was, which is funny because a lot of divers are the opposite. Going forwards is the easiest sort of dives. And there was a dive that every girl in the world basically started with. It was like a front 3.5. And I was the only girl in the world that didn't start with it, because my aerial awareness, one day I did the dive and I landed on my feet and on my head, and I just never did it again. So I always started off with a different dive to everyone at the rest of the world on a world stage.
That's
because
good.
Yeah, just because aerial awareness, though, like, it does, like, some people, it's just a thing where, like, you just have no idea where you are. Like,
you can't
like really train it if you just don't have it. So yeah, a lot of work on the trampolines, a lot of work with like a harness where you're strapped in and you do the 3.5 somersaults on a trampoline,
mm-hmm.
and your coach like catches you at the end. So,
right, so
yeah, a lot of...
As in like off the trampoline onto something? Or
No. Like, you'll do it and he'll hold you up. So then you'll like do like a handstand trampoline, like as if you're going into the water.
I see.
Yeah. Fair enough. A lot of that sort of training, which helps, but still, like, it's different when you know someone's catching you than when you're on a 10-meter platform. So,
I guess what are the... And I'm sure this is ever evolving, like it is in every sport. And I think of like motocross for some reason. You know, it's like the first time someone did a double backflip, like, whoa, now they're doing like triples, like it's nothing.
Yeah.
What is the tricks that are the most difficult, or even the types of tricks? You know, you sort of said there, you know, when you're standing forward, backwards, in handstand position, what gets the most marks? Is it obviously something that's just wildly intricate and harder to do?
Well, in diving, you have to do, at the Olympic level, for girls, you have to do 5 dives. For boys, you have to do 6. And they have to
Why is that?
Why do guys have to do 6?
Yeah.
I don't know, because...
Make them do more.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, because if there was 6 dives for a girl to do at the Olympics, I probably wouldn't have gone, because I couldn't do the front one. In diving, there's 6 directions. So front, inward, back, reverse, handstand, and twist. Guys have to do a dive from every direction at the Olympics. Girls have to pick from the 6, have to do 5. So that was like beneficial for me, because I didn't dive forwards. Mm. I only did reverse, inward, back, twist, and handstand. So yeah, every dive has to be different. And before a competition, you have to put your dive list in, what order you're doing them, what dives you're doing them. You have to have a certain amount of degree of difficulty. And then once on the day, you can't change the dive. So if you get up there and your dive sheet says you're doing a back 3.5 somersault and you do a forward 3.5 somersault and it's great and it's perfect, it's disqualified. Like, you have to do it in that order.
Wow.
And set, because they call it over the mic and everything. So yeah, once your dive list is in, it's in. And then with diving as well, like, to make a team, there was a certain amount of difficulty you had to have.
In, when you say difficulty, you had to have, in
so what, like, respect, a back 3.5 somersaults is like 3.2 degree of difficulty. So like, overall with the five dives, you had to have a certain number of difficulty to be able to make.
What's the highest five?
For a girl, the highest I think was 3.4.
Oh, so it's not a round number.
No.
Oh, it's,
yeah, it's weird. Diving's weird though. Like, it is, a back, yeah, 3.5 somersault in diving is called a 207. So forwards is one, like, okay, it's hard to explain. So no, like, a 207 is like, two means you're going backwards.
Yeah.
Zero means that you're not doing any twists.
Rotations.
And yeah, seven means the amount of somersaults you're doing. So you're doing 3.5. So you're doing a back nose twist, 3.5 somersaults. And then C is tuck position. So then over the speaker at like the Olympics or something, they'll say, Brittany Braven competing 207C. 3.3.
But only the divers and the judges know what that means. Unless you're really,
yeah,
into it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, she's so, doing a 207 C, love. Yeah, I thought, yeah, she was going to do a 311 C3PO.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, even my last dive at the Olympics was like a 5253B. And like, yeah, which is like, five is a twisting dive. Two is like the amount of like, some, it's like, yeah. It's
can great. Can you make up a something, a routine that no one's done before and submit that?
You don't.
So do there's it. All the combinations have been done. There'll never be more. There'll never be. It's
there'll
just
be more. There, like, there has been more over the last couple of years, but like, there's not like, there's nothing that someone would get up there and we would be like, what are you doing? Like, you just would know. Like,
okay.
There's just, yeah.
So all the combinations have kind of been done.
But people have added somersaults in. So like, for instance, like, there's like inward and back, oh no, not back, inward and front 4.5 somersaults now. Whereas back in the day, it was more so just 3.5 somersaults. So people are just getting stronger and doing harder dives.
Yeah, but it's still the same acquisition, if you will, or the same,
yeah,
routine. It's just that
you can only go from
them.
Six directions. There's not actually.
Yeah, that's, yeah, the thing. There's only so many ways you can, yeah, do it. I think the only progression is more flips,
yeah,
more
twists, yeah,
in the air, and that's it.
Yeah.
What was there any, like, you said sort of your hardest dive, but what was,
yeah,
your favorite dive? If you had like a signature one.
I had my first dive that I started with all the time, which was a reverse 2.5. So you're standing facing the water and you jump out and back. So you kind of do a somersault.
Oh, that's sick.
Yeah.
Jump forward, back flip.
Yeah. And that was my, that was what I was sort of known for in Australia. Although the degree of difficulty was low, because that was the dive that everyone started doing the front 3.5 somersaults, but I didn't do it. But I started with the reverse and the degree of difficulty was low, but I always kind of like did it well, so it was okay.
And maybe it, for you, it was a bit of an anchor, because you were like, if I start with this,
yeah,
start,
exactly,
with what I know real well, and then you can just build,
yeah,
build,
but
build,
do you know
build,
it's
build.
Funny, because I, like, in the prelim and the semi-final at the Olympics, I got like 9, 9.5 for it. It was like my best dive, like, so good. And then the Olympic final came and I like started with like 7, 7.5, and it was my best dive, and I was like,
like, they were judging,
yeah,
hard.
Yeah. No, it was, I slightly stuffed it up, which is like, I still kick myself to this day. But
is it the way you enter the water that
they're
judging mostly?
Yeah, I went like slightly, I wasn't straight, I was slightly off. And
so are you, obviously you're meant to be as straight as possible,
yeah,
and is it like the less impact on the water the better?
The less splash,
yeah,
is better. But they also judge your, from you like walking out, how you stand, you,
everything
they judge these days, yeah.
There you go. Mm. There you go. It is fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, it does make sense though, in a way, because,
yeah,
obviously there's only so many elements. It's a, it's something that's very quick.
Yeah.
You know, it's over very fast, you know, the,
yeah,
sport's very much like javelin, right? You throw the javelin, boom, that,
yeah,
sort of stuff. Yes, it's distance, but,
yeah,
technique's got a lot to do with it. But then, you know, thinking something like boxing, which goes for, you know, a longer time, and,
yeah,
then you've got like Formula One, which goes for hours. So,
yeah,
it's interesting how you can put so much effort into something,
oh,
where your competitive time on the platform,
like,
or
10 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's,
that's
crazy.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. I did think of that. like if you add up all the minutes that you're actually competing at the Olympics, it's like probably like 3 minutes for like years and years of
And what was it like when you got awarded the silver medal? Do you remember the moment, the feeling?
I actually do remember getting my medal and like closing my eyes on the podium, and I was like, this will probably never happen again in your lifetime, so like enjoy it, which is true. Like not a lot of divers other than Chinese divers and the occasional other country divers go back to back with medals. Like it's just not a thing in diving. Like you really do, if you win a medal, like I don't know, you peak in, there is a thing that you do peak in diving, and you can keep going, but like I was definitely at my peak at a young age, and like the only reason I didn't keep going was through injuries. And once you have a shoulder surgery, your body's completely different. Once you get injured, your body's completely different. So yeah, in that moment I was like, and then I just had to go back to like year 11 at school, which was awful for me.
Yeah, like, I mean, that's a bit of a come down, isn't it? That's an anticlimax.
I remember being in English class like a couple of weeks after the Olympics when everyone's like in Greece on holidays and doing all this, and I had to go back to school. Oh, and my teacher like kept me back after, and she's like, I feel like you just don't want to be here.
I've just been at the Olympics, mate.
Yeah. I was just in a food court with Usain Bolt and Michael Phelps and like seeing, and I was like, now I'm sitting here like,
with you.
Yeah. And I think I remember saying to her, like, honestly, like, I don't.
Good on you, honest. What did she say to that?
She's like, okay. I was like, yeah, so. But that was the hard thing about being so young, is that, like, that was hard for me coming back because, you know, I had to go to Junior World Championships, like, a month later. So I was straight back to training. And I remember crying on my first day back because I was like, holy crap. Like, I just did, like, what I achieved my life goal, and now I'm just back here. Like, am I? And that I struggled a long time with that just sort of starting again and just keep, like, it was like,
I think a lot of people would, that reintegration when you compete at such a high level, everything can feel numb after that.
Yeah,
because you always kind of want more, but then you're like, well, where do we go from here? And that goal's removed, so then it's it is quickly to establish other different types of
and
goals.
It was hard when you get an Olympic silver medal and like a lot of people who are athletes understand but don't, but like the only thing better I could have done is win a gold. And I knew that like that chance when I was 24 years later probably wouldn't happen. So like it's hard to keep going at something where you know you'll probably never do better than you have. So and that's why when I like finally retired, I was like, well, I was never going to get better than I had done. So yeah, a part of me does sometimes like wish I was just 17 and had the guts to just walk away and like not struggle through the next sort of 8 years of my career, because it was just a constant struggle from that medal. Like I wish like if I could go back, I would just comfortably walk away. Just, but when like you're a kid and like that, you've achieved your goal, no one's gonna be like, oh yeah, just retire now.
No,
like,
and you're still young as well. Yeah. Like age relative to a lot of people who compete, they usually retire because of an age factor.
Yeah,
but this was like, well no, I'm not even hit my fucking 16. prime. Yeah. Like, but so, again, there's other factors.
Yeah, definitely.
I imagine obviously you've got your like your swimsuit, your medal, have you still got all that like frame somewhere, all like memorabilia?
My medal is honestly in a drawer tucked away somewhere my mum put it. It's Olympic medals, you don't really get framed and hang up because like they are worth a bit, so you know if you were to get like robbed, you don't want someone to take that because you can't actually replace it.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. But I have like, yeah, I have definitely have memorabilia around. But like I said, that 8 years I went through was a big mental struggle for me, so I don't really like talk much about diving or like show it off much, which is crazy, but I've always been a very like humble athlete.
I was just gonna say, you strike me as someone who's very humble.
Only because I've always like, you know, I've been to the top level of sport, like I've done like the top level in my sport, but I'm like humble enough to know that there are people in their sport that are just as good. Like I feel like a lot of people that aren't humble don't realize that like you're the best at that, but you're not the best at everything else, like which I like, yeah, I was definitely humbled a lot after the Olympics just with things, because you just go up and down. So it's like, that's why when people are really confident, not confident, but like sort of cocky in their self and their sport, I'm just like, I've done what you've done as well. You're not better than anyone. You're better than that person in that, you know, that sport or that sort of activity that you do, but it doesn't make you better in life.
Doesn't. No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's a great perspective as well, Brett, to have, because, you know, it's sure, confidence is great, cockiness is a fine line, but at the end of the day, just because you got amazingly good at one thing doesn't make you better than anyone else.
Exactly, yeah.
Or just have the right to maybe treat people disrespectfully.
Yeah.
And not empathy. If anything, you should be a role model. But also, something that's probably humbling, as you mentioned before, some of the athletes you're around, I'm not sure if you made some good friends while you were there. Hopefully you did, because I know a lot of the time, as much as it can be competitive, there's a collectiveness about going away with people who you're like, you get me, like, yes. You know, even if you're doing a different thing, like, you understand the struggle and the discipline, so you kind of have some common ground. I don't know if you've connected or made friends with people when you were away, or if you're still in touch with. That might have been a good experience, but
I have a few close diving friends that, like, it's funny because they're probably the only people in my life that really get what you've been through, that we all deal with the same mental health issues, like, we deal with the same body stuff, all of it. And it's funny because I can, like, sit there and talk to them about how I'm feeling, and I feel better than talking to, like, a therapist, because they get you, like, they feel it. And it's hard to, like, explain to someone, because, like, you know, you can look at my story and, like, look at the things I've been through and be like, oh, that sucks. Like, it's like, it does suck, but, like, it's still an ongoing thing with all the things that you've been through in your life that you still deal with every single day. But there are, like, my closest friends, some of my closest friends are from diving, and they're not diving anymore, but we can still sit and we just talk about how in life now it still affects us in certain ways. So it definitely, you are and I mean, you're bonded when you spend your whole life with, like, those people. Especially my coach, when I went, the one that I went to the London Olympics with, he was like a dad to me. I saw him more than my dad. And even though he flogged me, I still, like, have a lot of respect for him, for what he was able to help me achieve at a young age.
Like you said, it does, they become family. You spend that much time with, you know, your athletes and your fellow, you know, peers, and then obviously your coaches. You do I always say it's a different type of relationship that you develop, you know, and there's that kind of rapport, and you get to know each other because you can tell your nuances and, you know, those are the idiosyncrasies that you probably can read in your partner now. You need to say, oh, you know what's going on. We could probably all relate to that.
Yeah.
I want to talk about as well, and I know we spent a lot of time on diving, but now, you know, transitioning into your own business and setting that up, and what that's like, and maybe even some correlations, because I imagine there is some correlations because you have to be very disciplined to run your own business, and obviously to be an Olympic athlete. So maybe talk about, like, what inspired you to run your own business and maybe some of those skills that have helped you in business so far.
To be honest, I started I went into sort of beauty and because I definitely didn't look after myself as an athlete as much as I should have. And like, you know, now I've created a space where I want people to come and look after themselves. So it's not just a beauty salon. It's actually more of like a wellness, relaxation, like a spa, like that sort of thing. Because, I've always, you know, since what I've been through in life, like, I just want people to come to a space to look after themselves, to, like, care about themselves, to sort of put effort into, you know, relaxing the mind, the body, things like that. So that's kind of like, it definitely correlates to, like, what I've been through in diving. And, like, now, you know, I work in, apart from the business side of it, in a relaxing environment where I want to sort of help people feel good about themselves. And like, you know, I work on people's skins, people's bodies, like, through massage, things like that, that, like, I want to make people feel good about themselves, because I wouldn't want anyone to feel like how I felt back in the day. So I think that's sort of like a main thing. And running my own business, like, I just personally like to be able to, like, make decisions. And, you know, I spent a good chunk of my life being told what to do, when to do it, how to do it. And now I can do whatever I sort of want. So I definitely do like, but I mean, it's a different sort of stress with business, and there's so many things that I have to learn as well. Like, I've only run a business for 7 weeks, and I got my first job when I was 20. Other than that, I wasn't an athlete. So now it's like, you know, I'm running a business. I haven't really had much more life experience than sport, but I think that really is a good discipline to have going into a business. But yeah, I just want to create a space where people are comfortable to come and chat and, you know, really like let themselves go. Like I've had a lady come in and she's struggling a lot with her little girl being sick, and she comes in and she's like, that's in that hour I just completely like sort of let go, and I was able to, and that's like the sort of like environment that I want to create, I guess. Yeah,
it's like another form of therapy in some respect.
Exactly, from a stressful sort of life to now creating that relaxation for other people.
That's great. And you know, I guess to be able to do that from, as you said, I'm your first job at 20, definitely, excuse the pun, throw yourself into the deep end there.
Yeah,
but you've got to do it. And it's interesting, like you said, you know, from having such a rigid, structured schedule to then going, you know what, I want to do things my way.
Yeah.
But also, I want to kind of pay it forward, if you look at it in that perspective,
definitely,
to people and make people just feel good internally and externally.
Yeah,
but it's funny because it's sort of like if you get the external, you can get the internal, and sometimes vice versa.
Yeah,
I speak to some of my coaches sometimes about fellow coaches. Yeah, people go, oh, you know, how do you get people to do this? How do you get people to adhere? And I'm like, sometimes it isn't about looking at it from the psychological perspective. Mm-hmm. It's about helping someone physiologically, i.e. if you get them moving and feeling good about themselves, sometimes that's the way to unlock maybe some conversations mentally.
Yeah.
Because if you change the physical state, you can change the mental. I use a really, really vivid example. If you chuck ice cold water over yourself, it's hard not to change your state.
Yeah.
So, you know, if again, you, for you, it might be sitting down, relaxing someone, it's touch, it's conversation, it's the smell, it's the immersion in that experience. Mm. And it's, I think it's wildly intricate to me how that affects the psychology. So sometimes it's not always sitting down and saying, this, you know, it's a bit of a blend, shall we say, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because I had like even a friend of mine who recently found out she's pregnant and she's quite young, and it was a shock to her, and like she came down on Saturday and she had a 2.5 hour package of just relaxing, and you know, she sent me a message being like, I haven't actually been able to fully relax like that in months, like, and it's just when you hear that or you have that, you've created that space for someone, like it's like, yeah, it's a great feeling.
It's what keeps you doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's the best thing I think about, you know, being a business owner is knowing that for most people, there's a few people out there who are perhaps doing it for the wrong reasons, but knowing that you're making a positive difference.
Yeah.
And when someone shows, displays, communicates that change, it's like, oh, it's all worth it.
Yeah.
It's like knowing that you have a purpose.
Yeah.
And I think that's a key human need we all want. We want to feel like we have a purpose.
Yeah, definitely.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
So to be able to pass that forward is great.
Yeah.
I wanted to move into some rapid fire questions before we wrap up with the final one.
Yeah.
And the first one is, and these are a little bit abstract, so again, you can get really deep with them, so whatever comes to mind.
Okay.
And it is, if you could choose a superpower, and you can make one up because there's no rules, what would it be and why?
Oh, that's a tough one. I don't know. Do you know what? I think this is probably like cliche, but also not. It's funny because like my superpower, I love my life now, my partner, my business, everything. But if I had a superpower, I'd love to go back and probably change my perception of when I was 17 so that I could build myself into a stronger woman than I am now.
Mm.
I think that would be. But then I also like, I feel like if you wish for that, then your whole life changed and you might not be where you are now. But, you know, superpower, I would go back and change my mentality from what I know now to be like.
There's so many things with that, the way, because you go, well, maybe you only get one go at it and you get two. I remember seeing this. I never actually watched Dragon Ball Z. I know some people will be like, how dare you? But I moved to New Zealand, everyone was into it.
Yeah.
And there was this one episode where they have this time chamber and he stops it and he goes, 1 minute in this time chamber was like 10 years.
Yeah.
So we got in it because this boss was coming, this bad person. So we trained for 10 years, came out in 1 minute and beat him. Because, so it was, it just reminded me of that, like going back and going, right, like, we can spend a year or 2 years and then you're still, but technically you get out and it's only been a minute.
Yeah.
And then you know, that'd be kind of cool. The next one is, for me, if you could wake up anywhere in the world tomorrow, because I know you have done a little bit of traveling, or maybe there's traveling that you want to do, where would it be and why?
Oh gosh. I have been to a lot of different countries of diving, but I've seen a lot of chlorine pools, not actually. probably New York. I went to New York with my dad back in 2014, and yeah, I don't know. I love America. I love America. I probably don't love like what Americans stand for sometimes, but I do love America. Noted. And yeah, just like being, I feel like a lot of Americans, when you go over there, like in the shops and everything, they're just so like nice and bubbly. And so I'd say New York.
The Big Apple.
Yeah, the Big Apple.
It's a good destination.
Yeah.
And my final question is, can you identify a fear that you've had in your life? And we've talked about a few on this podcast, or one that you currently have, if you feel sharing it, and if you have overcome it, what you learned or what you did to overcome it, or if it is still a current fear, maybe what you're doing to work through that.
I have a lot of fears, actually. I think as I've gotten older, they've developed. Like, I think I have my biggest fear right now is how quickly life is going. Like, it's funny because, like, you know, a lot of people can be like, oh, I wish I was 20 again or 21. It's like, I actually don't wish I was younger, because right now in my life, I have everything that I want. Like, you know, I'm running my own business. I've got a partner that I've been with for years now, and like everything is good. But the fear of like life is going so quickly. And, you know, I see my parents getting older. I see like my grandparents getting older. And I think as you get older, life seems to go so fast. So I think that's probably my biggest fear, is like not realizing how quickly life goes and not enjoying the moment. And that's probably why I have the biggest regrets when I was younger, because I just like wish so much time away, because I just wasn't enjoying life. And now you're older and you're like, damn, I don't want to wish like any time away. So yeah, seeing other people getting older and like myself, like thinking like, you know, the Olympics felt like yesterday to me, and now I'm turning 27 in a few weeks, and I'm like, oh my gosh, where does time go? Like, where did the last 27 years go? Like, it's crazy. So that's really my biggest fear.
Yeah, and relatable.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have that fear, because you like, you're so content with, I'm so content with my age and life now, but then I see like my parents, and you think 10 years ago was so, to you it seemed like yesterday, and then you think in 10 years time, oh my god, my parents are going to be this age, and like I'm going to be this age, and like it's, yeah, that, yeah.
Yeah, we can get into that loop sometimes, can't we? And we're all guilty of it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we all do. We should be more present. But then I don't know about you, but oh, I was told so many times, oh, it's going to go fast. You know, when you're young, it'll go fast because you're in school and you hate it.
Yeah.
To a degree. And you're like, yeah. And then all of a sudden you're like 30. Yeah. And you're like, shit, they were right. And then you're telling people. So,
yeah, no, definitely.
I guess a little adjunct to that then, before we sort of maybe wrap up with some handles, is, you know, if you could advise the people listening and watching one thing to do every day, completely free, that would enhance or add to their life, or something that you've found that's added to your life, what would you recommend? What would you say?
I think I sort of am trying to live more like this, but like, you have to really look after yourself, like, because, you know, a lot of people on this earth care about you and care about what you do, but no one really cares more about your life and what you do than you. And I feel like you need to do things that make you happy, and maybe not so much care about what other people think if it makes you happy. So I think that's a big one each day, because, you know, I lived a lot of my life trying to please other people, trying to perform for other people, and it just, like, at the end of the day, like, you know, you can walk away from a sport and none of those people care now about you. Like, I think you really have to do things every day for yourself, which I'm still trying to do, because at the end of the day, it's just you in this world. Like, you have your loved ones and your family that care so much about you, but like, to other people, it's like, you have to focus on you and doing this life how you want to do it, I think is a big thing that I'm trying to sort of teach myself as well still.
That's a really critical point to finish on. More people should serve themselves before they serve others.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That's a podcast in itself.
Yeah.
Brit. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's part two. Teaser. I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate you sharing. And for people who may want to connect or come and see you, spend some time, you know, with your service experience, yeah. some of your time, where's the best place to connect, to go to book in, etc.?
So we have a system to book online now. So the business is called Marlow Lane Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And we're on Instagram as well and has all the details on there. So yeah, a little salon in on the Lower Burleigh Highway in Burleigh Head. So
beautiful location in the Gold
yeah.
Coast.
Yeah. It is a perfect location. The light rail and all the roadworks happening around, I'm hoping, doesn't cause any sort of stress. But I feel like, yeah, there's a lot of roadworks and construction going around. But where we are is a really, it's a good little spot. It's a good little pocket. Very lucky.
I'm sure it'll only get better as well once that is all done
yeah.
and completed.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah.
Mm. Awesome. Well, we'll put those links in the descriptions as always, team. So if you've got any questions or you want to book in with Britt, please do so. Again, Britt, I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Yes. It's been a very interesting conversation.
Yeah.
And for those of you watching, as you know, if you enjoyed it, pay it forward. And until the next time, stay fearless. For those of you who are confused, frustrated, and sick and tired of not seeing the results that you want or deserve, make sure that you click the Apply for Coaching button in the description below and line up a completely free consultation with myself, where we can discover if it's a good fit as client and coach and take your health and physique to the next level once and for all.